You're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and my guest today is Jared Hempstead. Jared's got a nose like a bloodhound, and he's translated his superior taste and work ethic into building one of the best brands in craft spirits, Balcones Distilling, which started under a bridge near the 18th Street overpass about 10 years ago. But before my conversation with this whiskey wizard, it's the word on the street. The conversation about conversion is heating up once again. Recently, the city of Waco held a public meeting at Central Library to discuss reverting Franklin and Washington Avenues to two-way streets. Opponents say the change would be really expensive and hamper the speed of traffic. Proponents say, well, that's exactly the point. Franklin, in particular, often feels more like a one-way highway than a city street. Slowing down the cars would allow drivers to notice the businesses more and allow pedestrians to feel safer while shopping. If you're interested in diving deeper on this issue and learning about the cutting-edge city planning conversations going on throughout our country, I encourage you to check out strongtowns.org. Strongtowns publishes terrific articles and a daily podcast with the goal of supporting a model of development that allows America's cities, towns, and neighborhoods to become financially strong and resilient. There's great content on this debate of reverting one-way streets back to two-ways, which is a topic in many cities across the U.S., and it's one that's far from settled here in Waco. So be sure to let your city council person know how you feel. You may even run into them while voting in your city primary elections on March 6th. Kudos to the city of Waco, which completed an environmental cleanup for the impending riverfront developments way under budget. The Texas Center for Environmental Quality is given a clean bill of health for the 18.5-acre site, which means that the $100 million Brazos Promenade project can finally move forward. The city spent about $6 million less than anticipated, meaning that that money allocated for environmental remediation now can go back into the general coffers of the TIF fund. Hannah Franzen is the local engagement coordinator for Towny, a mobile app that makes it easy to find old and new local businesses and access exclusive deals that benefit you and your community. She's also a graduate of Dr. Marlene Reed's BEST program from Baylor. Welcome to the program, Hannah.
Thanks, Austin. Thanks for having me.
I love Dr. Reed, had her on the show before. Tell me a little bit about what you learned in BEST that has helped with the community engagement you're trying to do with Towny.
Yeah, so I am an alumni of Baylor, and in Dr. Reed's BEST program, I really have to say the case studies that she would make us read were really instrumental in my love for the entrepreneurial world and understanding just the importance and value that small businesses bring to a local economy.
135 businesses have signed up for Towny. It just launched officially in Waco last weekend. Some of the businesses that people might know: Common Grounds, the Hippodrome, La Fiesta, Bear Arms Brewing. These are all businesses that are on the Towny app. You can learn more about them and get exclusive deals. But there's also a ton of businesses on there that maybe people haven't seen before and they want to engage with. What are some of your favorites that are on the app that people might not know about yet?
I would have to say it's hard to pick favorites. However, a few to mention just are Baked Bliss Bakery, Oh My Juice, LaSalle Shops, Shabby Shades, Rock Ready Printing, Rock My Style. Yeah, there's over 100 like we said, and we love all of our local businesses here in Waco.
So if a listener were to go to the App Store and download Towny, T-O-W-N-Y, what would they see on their smartphone?
So when you download it, you would see a filter where you can choose the category of local businesses that you want to find and search. So before you do that, it'll ask you to enter in your email address, and then you get access. That will allow you to have access to the app and the exclusive promotions and deals. And really, we believe in our local merchants here in Waco, because they're the ones that are invested in the Waco of today and tomorrow. And the heart behind what we do is that, you know, studies show that when you spend locally, more than half of what you spend stays in the local economy. And so at Towny and with our app, we're just trying to facilitate that process and make it easier for people to find your local businesses.
Hannah Franzen, local engagement coordinator for Towny, thank you so much for coming on Downtown Depot.
Thanks, Austin.
We are now joined in the KWBU studio by Jared Hemstedt. Jared is the head distiller at Balcones Distilling on 11th Street in downtown Waco. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about your history in Waco.
I don't think, I can't remember how many of my grandparents went to Baylor, but yeah, it was grandparents, then parents. So by the time it was time to pick colleges, I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew that going to UNLV or North Carolina just because I like their basketball teams wasn't a good way to make that
decision.
You
were a big Larry Johnson fan back in the day?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And where were you growing up?
My parents are missionaries, so we were in Brazil.
Oh, wow.
Until I was 17. Moved here in 93 to finish high school and then been here since. I worked with Mission Waco part-time on and off during college, me and my wife both. And so graduation was coming around. We graduate, we get married, we're trying to figure out what we're going to be doing. And they really kind of wanted us to stay around. So so we did that and moved into a house. People think Waco's got a sweet housing market now. Man, our first house was like, I think we paid $24,000 for it.
Oh, man. And was this in that sort of Colcord area?
It was actually
Mission
a little bit further down.
Okay.
But yeah, somebody had donated the house to Mission Waco, and it had had a fire. So all they did was like throw a roof on it. So my wife left there after Mission Waco, about maybe like 3 years or so of doing that.
So was this early 2000s?
Yeah. Okay. And then she worked at the Methodist home for a while, teaching math. She was actually a juvenile probation officer for a while. And then I went ahead and stayed. I was there probably about 8 years, I guess, after we got married. And in the meantime, another friend of mine who's still here in town had gotten me some homebrewing equipment as a wedding gift. And I don't even think I used it right away. I kind of like messed around with it a little bit, but nothing fancy. But over the years, that kind of kept – I was doing that more seriously. And then when I would finally met a few other people, they were homebrewers. And so then it got – and it's like, you know, no, it's not pre-internet, but I mean we weren't using it quite like it gets used today. So
yeah.
Until I'd met other people – I, you know, could buy a few books here and there, but otherwise.
So I had Paxton Dove, the owner of Dancing Bear Pub, on here in October 2016, and he had talked about this early craft scene in Waco. Is that what you're talking
about?
Yeah.
So his version is probably not that different from the version I was.
I mean, the way that he described it was just some beer nerds who didn't really have many places to drink in Waco, and
right.
So they'd get together, talk craft, learn.
Yeah,
how to
and there wasn't a lot even coming in to stay. I mean, for craft people today, it's like. The brands that were available would probably be boring to people today, but it was like we could get some Sierra Nevada, we'd get some Anchor. There was imports. We probably drank a lot more imports back then, that generation of craft beer guys, than people do today because there's so much domestic options. It was like I've kind of, you know, drink all the American stuff I can find. And so like my age group probably has a more of affinity for like, you know, Vienna lagers and pilsners and stuff, old world style stuff, because it was like, man, if I'm going to try and drink everything that's available to me, that was a huge chunk of it. That probably wasn't very fresh or well refrigerated. But yeah, so out of that group, there was multiple, and Paxton's probably told the same story. There's multiple attempts at kind of like getting a brew pub going. And in hindsight, there was some, obviously it would have been easier if we'd had more money. then financing wouldn't have been a big a deal. Some of those groups, we were maybe a little bit too inclusive. There's some people that had like really strong opinions on what this kind of, you know, small brewery / restaurant would look like. And anyway, too many cooks in the kitchen a couple of times. So that just never happened. But out of that came, obviously, the Dancing Bear was one offshoot from that group. And really, Balcones was the other. So I left Mission Waco to open Dancing Bear with Paxton, and we had goals to brew there. And it didn't take long after getting in there before realizing the space was just way too tiny. Like we'd kind of overestimated how compressed we thought we could pull off brewing in there. Mm. So I was like, yeah, there's no way. We'd have to add on to the building. Something else would have to happen.
To run a big operation, like I was over in East Waco at Brotherwell Brewing a few weeks ago, it is almost surgical how much equipment they have and the sanitary needs that are totally important to making good beer.
Yep. It'd
be really hard to do that in a small space.
It's not something you want to try and wedge in, like where people are like, they're walking by and they're bumping into you and they're grabbing things out of the fridge they need. Like, yeah. but so, yeah, and as often happens in life, there was beer everywhere. And a good friend of mine who doesn't live in Waco anymore had spent some time in Oxford. And being a beer guy, everyone, especially single malt Scotch guys, are always like, oh, so you probably – it's like the same thing. It's like you ferment, you make beer, you distill it, turns into whiskey. They kind of start in very similar ways. But I never really did. People come and share things or – I'll show you like this. You like this. I just never – whiskey never really clicked for me. And then during those years, the pub was getting going, just like beer everywhere. Found myself kind of getting tired of it. And then I was out with my friend who had spent some time in the UK. And apparently I'd never had any peated scotch before because we were out some time. I think we maybe were at Hemingway's, and which once again, you know, 10 years ago. Nobody had good whiskey selections in town. And anyway, so he starts walking me through some of the stuff he liked, which was all peated Islay scotch. And the very first, it was an Ardbeg. And it was just like, oh.
That's when you
got it. Now I get it. Wow. And I talk a lot of people have these kind of moments with, they're like, what was your kind of aha moment with
whiskey? Do you remember what it was specifically, what whiskey you were drinking?
It was Ardbeg was the brand, but I don't think their 10-year-old was out yet because they closed and they had reopened. So it must have been one of the earlier releases, so maybe like a 7 or 8-year-old. It's not something you can get now. And it probably, what the 10-year-old up is better than what they were. But they were kind of giving these preview blends. So like we were not really ready to get the 10-year-old back out yet because the distillery hadn't been reopened that long. But they were doing these like almost there, not quite as young. They had all these cute names for like these releases that we were doing. That weren't age stated leading up to the 10-year release.
And did your background in craft brewing help with your whiskey distilling and understanding flavor profiles?
Yeah, and a lot of what we do at Balcon is a little bit weird. It is because of brewing like concepts, and we were probably a little naive. Once again, this is a different era. There's so much more information out there. Even going and trying to find distilling books, like there just wasn't that much. And some of the ones literally are like reprints of things that were written in like the 1836 or something.
Wow.
Like these like really random books. Now there's like just, I mean, people are writing.
The industry was ripe for an information overhaul.
Yeah, big time. So unless you knew somebody, there just wasn't that much you could find out, and a lot. Whiskey's funny. It's just, I mean, people have so much, they're kind of like little secretive, like they don't want to talk about certain things that they think are like the key to how theirs is different from someone else's. So you can find out some, but we kind of asked ourselves some questions based on how you would do it if you were doing beer, that some of the whiskey stuff just kind of like, man, that's really weird. Why would anyone do that? And once again, it was a little ignorant. Some of those questions, if we knew more, maybe we wouldn't have asked, which is why I'm really glad we didn't know more, because I think we, made some weird choices and tried some things that made sense on the beer side that are not how either Kentucky or Scotland does whiskey, but just made more sense that we do to this day. And I think we do end up with kind of some really different results.
Jared, I got to stop you there because what you just said is such an important reminder for entrepreneurs that if you are doing something that's truly innovative, there's not going to be a playbook for how you're supposed to do it. And it really is just about trying things and experimenting. And for me, it's I can walk through that wall because I don't see that there's a door there. I'm too dumb to know that there's a door there.
Right.
But I know that I want to be on the other side of that, and I'm willing to put my head down and run through it.
Right. there's a level of it's always nice to have as much information as you can have going into something. But we've learned this too. I mean, obviously Scotland and Kentucky, Ireland, like there's places with – you know, over a century of distilling tradition, and they do the things the way they do them. But when you're new, and like, I don't know all of these different parameters and all these different facets of the process that result in this, why each of these things are done the way they're done. And the irony was that they've been doing it so long, the more we asked, the more we kept getting answers like, well, that's how we do it. So whoever at some point or whatever group of people accumulated knowledge over generations that landed on, here's how at fill-in-the-blank distillery, this is how we do things. This is the fermentation temperature. This is how much yeast we add. This is our recipe. This is whatever. This is our final pH, blah, blah, blah. They landed on that, and they've been doing it for a long time. And now they have a customer base that is expecting that specific flavor profile, people that like it. They want it that way. So they have some incentive to stay within those boundaries. But I was just kept being amazed, even retired, like master distillers from – American distilleries that don't even exist anymore. The more I sought these guys out to like pick their brains on stuff, and like they didn't know. They didn't know necessarily why they did some of the things they did. It's like, this is how we do it here.
Yeah. So like the process had been shared, but maybe not necessarily the knowledge had been shared.
Or the kind of the reasons behind. But it is that experimentation. Somebody at some point was playing around and they kept tweaking it and they found something they really liked, and now they've been doing it for 100 years. But it was odd and a little uncomfortable to find out that those people weren't going to even be able to tell us what we were looking for. So the obvious answer was, well, I guess we got to try a bunch of stuff and try and keep good data and pay really close attention and find out, like, is there a reason why? Is there something that could be done better and we just don't – no one's tried it because we've been doing this a certain way for 100 years plus. And not everything we do is super weird, but we definitely find out some interesting ways of doing things that aren't typical. And I think the final result of a bunch of little decisions that are just a little bit different, all that combined, definitely – I feel like I hear other people say that a lot. That, you know, obviously you'd love for everyone to say they really like your whiskey, but I think the final result is unique in a couple of specific ways. They're like, yeah, some of these things I just don't really get in anything else. Like, which that in itself is not great either. Someone's like, oh, it's unique. But like, well, is it good? Well, no, but it's really unique. Like, that's not the goal either. But to have people like it and also feel like there's some unique stuff going on that they don't find other places is pretty rewarding. But yeah.
You're hearing from Jared Hemstedt, head distiller at Balcones Distilling, downtown Waco. You have the core range of Baby Blue, Brimstone, the Texas No. 1 Single Malt, and Rumble. Give our listeners one word to describe each one of those.
Man, that's tough. Have you heard those? You probably haven't. Glenmorangie has their little ads where they have their head distiller, Bill Lumsden, their master distiller. They'll like mention one of the expressions and he's got like 8 seconds to say 5 words or something. And you're going to make me do one
word. Making you do one.
One word. So I probably would say Rumble, maybe unexpected with Rumble. It's got some weird ingredients. People think it's a whiskey. There's no grain involved. It's fruit and honey and other things. And people find themselves liking it and then whispering, like, don't tell my friends, but my favorite one's Rumble, and I know it's not even a whiskey. I'm a whiskey guy. It's like, I won't tell anybody. Baby Blue. That's a tough one. I mean, we're trying to make a corn whiskey that tasted like corn because all bourbons are majority corn and they taste more like wood than anything else a lot of the times. Maybe youthful. I mean, it's intentionally trying to be young to make sure that the raw material shines through instead of the barrel aging. So maybe youthful for baby. Brimstone, I might just have to say, maybe I pick between either just Texas or barbecue. But yeah,
it's Texas in a bottle.
Yeah,
it's
it really
a campfire.
Is. Yeah, it's campfire. It's ribs and brisket and the campfire when you're passing the whiskey around and then you go to bed. You didn't shower. You maybe didn't even take your clothes off. You just call it a night and you get up and the smoke's all on you. And I feel like, yeah, you can just get that right from the beginning.
All
you don't
even
have to
bottled.
Wait till the next morning to have the whiskey coming out of your pores with the smoke. You can just go straight for it. Single malt would be the hardest for me to say in one word. It's my favorite. It's definitely like the reason we started the distillery was to make single malt. We were Scotch guys. I don't know. I might have to go with just classic, not even in the sense that it's exactly. It's actually very different in a lot of ways from what people expect if they're Scotch drinkers. But the things that are different about it are familiar from other American whiskey styles, the wood profile, some of the spice, the body, tannin, things that aren't usually in Scotch that are in other American whiskeys. So both components are very familiar. They're just combined in a way that I think was kind of new.
Well, and you can find these core products at liquor stores almost everywhere now. It's really hard for me to walk in anywhere and not see Balcones or be asked by someone in the store if I've tried Balcones before. And one reason for that greater production is because y'all recently moved into a new space there in downtown. And a building that was there since 1923, the old Texas Fireproof Company storage building. What has the move into that space, which is about 25 times larger than where you had been distilling, what has that brought for your business?
what's funny, even doing this show with you, I know you focus a lot on kind of people that are kind of at their core entrepreneurs. And ironically, I don't really think we are a lot of the business side of things. I wouldn't say it's an afterthought, but it's definitely those decisions and even all the time and energy that's spent on the business side of things is – it all plays a supporting role to what we really want to do, which is just be really serious about our craft, our trade, which is making whiskey, just like never stop making it better, just, you know, really high standards for excellence. We're probably the pickiest with beer and whiskey both. We probably more often than not hurt people's feelings when they think they're really excited and want to share something because, like, we're pretty picky. Our standards are really high. We've had it all before. We want it to be exceptional on both ends. And so when I think about what the move and the expansion are doing for us, I'm usually thinking about process. Mm-hmm. We have a lot – we're running steam instead of fire. We have much better direct control over still temperatures and the kind of the roadmap for how we run the stills every day, which means we can do better data collection. We can make tweaks. We can track it. We can connect it with the whiskey later when it's ready. And, like, everything from the jacketed fermenters, which we didn't used to have, allows us to control fermentation temperature. So basically every step of the process and all these ideas we always had of, like, what would this do? What would that do? We can make literally tiny, tiny, tiny changes that maybe nobody else is ever going to really notice, but allow us to just kind of, like, man, really fine-tune and tweak things we really like about what we're already doing. If there's something we just kind of like, man, I'd really like to bump up that that note, or I'd really like to minimize this, or the balance between the mouthfeel and the fruit, whatever, and keep playing with it until we're hopefully over a whole lifetime get to keep toying with it and getting closer and closer and closer to feeling like we really are done, like that it's exactly what we always wanted it to be. You can't really do research. Tommy Moat, who's our production manager, gets really anal about, like, when things really are or aren't scientific. And he's like, that's just anecdotal. That doesn't mean anything. So but the idea of doing everything in triplicate and stills run different times a year because there's atmospheric temperature and things going on. So we just couldn't control for a lot of that before. That's probably been one of the most rewarding things, is to actually know. You're like, well, we did that weird thing one day, and it gave us, you know, back at the old building, it gave us a barrel. It's like, well, barrels are made out of wood, and wood is basically an agricultural product. It varies year to year, soil content, water, rainfall that year. Every barrel you get is not exactly the same, even if they were made from the same tree or two trees right beside each other. So if you don't do three or four and then do some sensory analysis and, like, take the outliers out and, you know, so we've been able to do a lot more of that, because when you make one or two barrels a day, obviously you can't do anything in triplicate. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, it's, you know, 10 to 20 barrels a day. And so we can actually save all that up and put them in as uniform a barrel as we can and try them at different floors of the warehouse, put them in at different entry proofs and see how our specific climate in our maturation area, what it does and which products are going to do better with some slight tweaks. And then maybe that one should be there. Maybe that should be there. And so in some ways, it feels like we've just begun, because whiskey takes so long. You try things. It's going to take a while before you know the result of that. And then you tweak, and then you wait a few more years, and then you're going to tweak again. So I feel lucky. I don't think I'm going to be doing it long enough for us to run out of things to try. But I think the big reward would be at the end of it to feel like the product kind of take a life of their own. Oh, I mean, this is our 10th year. So, I mean, some of these things people have been enjoying for a long time. So now you feel responsible to all these people, some of which you know and some of which you'll never meet, that care about this. And now you're kind of a steward of this thing. It's like, it doesn't matter that you started it. At this point, it has its own relationship to people and its own place in their life. And so now it feels like you're serving, you know, like you're kind of help ushering this thing into being its best, the best version of itself. And I always joke with Tommy, because those guys are so much younger than I am, that I think whoever's kind of driving the creative side of the process should have their fingerprint on stuff, and they should always be able to enjoy what we're making. And so the irony is that I think we're going to keep messing with things, and, you know, the gaps super big, and then it's like every iteration, like you're getting closer and closer, and so the differences get more and more subtle every time, and then I'll finally be old and done, and they'll probably, you know, wait till I'm out the door and be like, change everything up. Never. I always hated the way the old man made the single malt or whatever, which they should. If that's what happens, they should absolutely do that. But
constant innovation is what you're looking for.
Yeah. But I mean, it's, yeah, we talk about this a lot. It's not, it's definitely not innovation or exploration just for its own sake. I mean, and some things we do, I mean, there are things that we do know. We do know what this will do and this will do and this will do. And we don't play around in that area. Like if it's something that is known, like there's good data, there's good research, there's good information about, then yeah, you don't go play with it just to play with it. That's that would be kind of foolhardy and not a good use of time. Like we got a lot to do and a lot of ideas and a lot of projects, and to waste them going down a road that someone else has already gone down and we know where that leads, like just because like what, you don't believe them or something, you know, or to prove something. But there's a whole world, and people haven't been doing whiskey in Texas as much as it seems like this idea, you know, this cattle drive and, you know, all the Western movies and saloons and all this stuff. We've yet to find any historical record of anyone actually ever distilling in Texas legally, ever. We usually just say, you know, first since Prohibition, but we've gone past that. And actually, we have some friends that are bourbon historians and things, and some of them think they've found maybe a few things that need to be researched further, but we haven't found anybody that was making whiskey in Texas ever, which is crazy. So all those cattle drive guys were drinking, probably drinking Kentucky bourbon or moonshine, I guess. People were probably making whiskey, but definitely not commercially or legally. So we're finding out a lot of things about climate here and how – how whiskey ages here, that are really just it's all new. So us and the other handful of Texas guys that are actually making their own stuff and not buying whiskey from somebody much bigger and selling it to Texans as if it was made in Texas, we're just all having a lot of fun finding out, what does whiskey do here? What does it want to do here? What's this climate? What does whiskey made here and aged here want to be like? So yeah, it's kind of a fun discovery. It doesn't feel like engineering. It feels like you're kind of, yeah, it feels more relational, like trying to get to know something, you know?
You're exploring, and will not stop exploring. Mm-hmm. Jared Hempstead, head distiller of the original Texas whiskey, Balcones Distilling in downtown Waco. Jared, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to my guests, Jared and Hannah, and for each of you for tuning in here on KWBU or Apple Podcasts or the NPR One app or through WacoBusinessNews.com. Listen to these stories from our community, share them with your friends, and reach out to me. I love hearing from listeners and interacting as often as my schedule allows. I'm Austin Meek with Waco Business News, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.